The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Those are some of the words, of course, inscribed at the base of the Statue of Liberty here in New York Harbor. For hundreds of thousands of refugees this summer, that golden door is Europe, and they are risking everything to get there. On Wednesday, images circulated online of a drowned 3-year-old Syrian boy lying face down on a Turkish beach. That photo, which many journalists and activists insisted be shown despite its graphic nature, was a stark reminder of the realities of a crisis that has gotten steadily worse as the summer has dragged on. Given the scale of the crisis, should we be doing more here in the United States? David Miliband is one of a growing number raising that question about our role here in America. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and a former foreign secretary in the United Kingdom.
Well, Europe has historically been a leader of the humanitarian system. It's been a leader of the drive for universal rights to be established. And there's no question that Europe is now in moral as well as political and policy crisis in the face of the tsunami of bad news, the terrible 4-5 year conflict in Syria, the ongoing conflict in Somalia and Congo that is producing a wave of refugees, the like of which the world has never seen before. Just for the benefit of your listeners, last year was a terrible world record, 20 million refugees around the world, 40 million people displaced within their own country. And the response of the international community, both in peacemaking in countries like Syria, but also in treating the symptoms of conflict, namely the refugee flow that results, has been very weak indeed. And Europe has been consumed by the crisis in Ukraine, by the euro crisis in Greece over the last 2 or 3 years, and frankly hasn't had its eye on the ball of this refugee crisis. That means that a country like Germany wakes up today and says, we're going to have 800,000 asylum seekers in our country this year. And this is certainly a European crisis that demands a European response. But frankly, it also demands an international response, including the United States, because historically the US has taken a very large number, about 50% of the world's resettled refugees. But since the Syria conflict started, only 1,434, to be absolutely precise, have arrived in the US. And so there has been inertia where there needs to be leadership. And that's really a fundamental challenge, yes, to the European countries that have got this stock of people now inside Europe who they need to share out, but also globally to tackle the roots of the problem and to deal with its symptoms.
So the U.S. government and the U.S. State Department has come under some criticism and, in your view, justified criticism for not taking a more active role with the crippling refugee crisis from the Syrian conflict. At the same time, Mr. Secretary, we are in the midst of a political season in this country where a big part of the conversation, frankly, is about the opposite. A major part of the debate right now, at least in the Republican primary, is about building a wall, building a fence between the United States and Mexico. Sure, on a practical level, it may never happen, but the symbolism of such a wall and such a fence and such an attitude, I would take it as a bit troubling to you.
Well, I obviously am a relative newcomer to the United States, as you can tell from my accent. I observe U.S. politics as an observer rather than as a participant, but I can bring to bear some experience from elsewhere. Look, the debate about walls in Europe has shown that the bigger the walls, the more ingenious or the more criminal are the attempts to get round them. The absence of legal routes into Europe for those fleeing for their lives means that there's real empowerment of criminal gangs who are the last hope for people who are being barrel-bombed in their homes in Syria and don't have legal routes to claim refugee status. And it's obviously not for me as the leader of an NGO to become involved in partisan politics, still less intra-party politics within the Democratic or Republican parties. But what I think is clear is that this country has historically been a leader in refugee resettlement and has been a leading light for the benefits of a diverse society. E pluribus unum, after all, has been the defining element of this country and has brought people from all around the world and actually brought people to New York, to this city, as the ultimate a global city. And I think that the management of refugee flows is a feature of the modern world, where the attempt to believe that it can that there can be crisis in the Middle East or crisis across Africa and not affect the rest of us just is belied by reality. And I hope that The positive examples of managed migration and managed refugee flows in the United States is something that Europeans will learn from in a positive way.
I found something missing, if I can say so, from the goals as I was looking through them, the lofty goals that we've discussed, these golden goals. Good health, no hunger, no poverty, climate action we've talked about, of course, reduced inequality. Mr. Secretary, one goal that isn't in here, that's an important one and a tough one, is less corruption. Less corruption in many of the governments that you and your colleagues at the UN will be dealing with to realize these goals. And it seems like political corruption, financial corruption is a major obstacle to the type of economic development that you're talking about.
I think it's a really important point that corruption is obviously a stain on the countries where it exists, but it's also a massive roadblock to achieving anything like the kind of equitable growth that is essential to help people out of poverty. I think it's important to emphasize that our experience at the International Rescue Committee, where we have helped last year about 17 million people in conflict zones around the world, is that when you work at community level, you can battle against the corruption that seems to mark some of the big projects, the big infrastructure projects that have often typified the attempt to establish a quick fix in different countries. And our learning in countries like Afghanistan is that when you work at local level, sometimes having to work around local state structures, you can establish the community confidence that money is being used for their benefit. And that's certainly a very important element of the transparency that's going to be vital if we're going to make progress. There's one other thing I think it's important to say that's missing in the way these goals have been framed. I think many people listening would be shocked to know that while 15 years ago about 10% of the world's extreme poor lived in conflict states, today that figure is 43% and it's on its way up to two-thirds. And our view from working in conflict states around the world is that the geography of poverty, the pattern of poverty around the world, is increasingly focused on those 30 to 40 countries where government doesn't work, where conflict is pervasive, sometimes where there are battles over resources, other cases where there's battles over religion or over ethnicity. And it's going to be vital over the next 5, 10, 15 years to ensure that in pursuing these lofty goals, we establish very clear floor targets to make sure that people in conflict zones are not left behind. So when we say we want to get 75% of kids into primary and secondary education and ultimately 100%, we must make sure that it's not the kids in the conflict states that get left behind. And the evidence at the moment in a country like Lebanon, where there's over 1 million Syrian refugees, there's over 300,000 kids not in education. And these are the basics of tackling poverty and ensuring that it's not transmitted to the next generation. And so I hope that there's a debate this September in New York, not just about the goals, but about their implementation. Because if we don't take that seriously, then we're not going to do justice to the ambitions that have been set out.
David Miliband, we're going to let you go right before we do. On a personal note, if I might, talk about your own motivation in being involved with International Rescue Committee and all of these issues when it comes to refugee crisis, education, healthcare, and conflict zones. Many Americans won't know that your own father, Ralph Miliband, was a Jewish refugee in World War II himself. This is part of your background.
Well, thanks for raising that. I mean, professional life and personal life do come together. My father and grandfather were refugees to the United Kingdom in 1940. My mother spent the Second World War in hiding in Poland and became a refugee to the UK in 1946. And so there is a personal element to the passion that I bring to the International Rescue Committee and the issues that we're addressing. As it happens, I also know that my grandfather, who spent the war in the UK with my dad, when he went back to Belgium in 1945 to rescue his wife and his daughter and successfully rescue them, he was then denied entry into the UK because there wasn't enough room for economic migrants as opposed to refugees. And one of the striking things about the current Europe crisis is that the distinction between a refugee and a migrant is being lost. A refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution. It's a legal status established in international law, and it's provided a life-saving haven for literally millions of people over the years, including my family. An immigrant, someone who's seeking a better life, is in a different category and doesn't have the same kind of rights. And I hope that there comes out of this Europe crisis a greater understanding of the need to defend the status of refugees as people in desperate need of help and in need of protection that has long been offered by countries like the US and the UK. And I'm honored to be part of the drive to help achieve that.
David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. He's also the former Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom. David Miliband, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.